Warren Alnybeck with To The Point. The Olympic flame won't be lit till tomorrow during the opening ceremonies, but the games themselves have begun near Sochi in Russia. Christopher Clary is there for the New York Times. And Christopher, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Where are you?
You know, I am actually in the figure skating arena, which is right in the center of what will for the next couple of weeks be called Sochi, but is actually quite a few kilometers from what is actually Sochi. We're down along the coast of the Black Sea. And I am here, and I just finished the first night of competition here, which just sounds funny because the opening ceremony is tomorrow, but the winter games, like the summer games, are expanding. And so it's bleeding into other parts of the week now.
What can you tell us about the first day of competition, or I guess it's a qualifying round, huh?
Well, actually, it's a qualifying round in slopestyle, which is one of the several new sports that are here this year, this Olympics. But figure skating is it's the real deal. It's a team competition. It's a brand new thing. Oh. Where they have 10 different nations competing. And tonight was the first night of that. So you had one of the Russian heroes, Yevgeny Plushenko, competed in the men's short program. And then you had the Americans and the Canadians. And then so it was already very much an Olympic atmosphere inside the arena. A lot of Russian flags, a lot of Russian chants. And give you a little picture of what's to come.
Any indication of who came out ahead?
The Russians, even though the games haven't started, are in the lead. So that's a good sign for their sports coming ahead. But there's a lot of sport to be played here, and obviously sport really hasn't been the main topic here, Warren, for the last couple of years. So I'm sure they're happy to get the game started.
I'm sure they are. Back to slopestyle snowboarding. There was a withdrawal of a very important figure from there. Tell us about that.
Well, Shaun White is one of the biggest stars in winter sport, you know, definitely a big-ticket athlete and has sort of brought a lot of these action sports really to the fore in the Olympics by winning the half pipe the last couple times of the games in the last two Winter Olympics. He was supposed to take part in this new event in the Olympics called slopestyle, was one of the favorites to do well, maybe not the gold medal favorite, and the hill here was a little crazy, even for these guys. I don't think he's feeling 100% fit physically, and he decided to pull out at the last minute. So that was quite a surprise, and I think a lot of his competitors were surprised, too.
He said he was concerned that he might get an injury. Apparently he jammed his elbow or his arm. Others said maybe he thought he wasn't going to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big ask to work on both of those at the same time. There's a lot of competition. He's getting a little bit older, and I think he feels his best chances in half pipe where he's already won. And I do think, you know, having watched that slopestyle course, he might have felt a little bit of apprehension too, which is, I think it might have been discretion being the better part of valor in this case.
What about all the concerns we've heard about unfinished hotel rooms and stray dogs and the other issues that have, as you indicated, been reported on more than the athletes, of course, who haven't begun to compete until today? How are things going now? Are they getting their act together?
You know, Warren, I mean, people get tired of the media complaining about their housing, so I won't waste too much of your program doing that. But they clearly left a lot of the media housing in particular until the last minute. I arrived earlier in the week, and there was mud on the floor, and you know, a lot of things weren't finished in the room. Furniture wasn't in there, so it was definitely not a complete thing. And you think if they'd spent $51 billion, they would have a finished product. But all I can tell you is they've been working very hard on all that. They've been hammering away, and the main thing is the venues themselves are, in some cases, magnificent, and they appear to all be finished. And I've talked to a lot of athletes in the last two or three days, and frankly, I haven't heard any complaints on their ends about the way things are going. So I think there's no question the Russians put some things off till the end, but it appears that the essential has been taken care of anyway.
What about security?
Huge issue, obviously. I mean, it's true in every games, to be fair. This one more so because of the neighborhood we're in here. This is not a great neighborhood. The place definitely feels down here near the Black Sea a bit like a fortress. They're fences, wires, all kinds of things everywhere. When you get up into the mountains, which is about a 45-minute drive up into the hills, security isn't quite as omnipresent. You feel a little bit more like you're out of touch with it. And you know, it's definitely a huge issue here. Everybody's thinking about it. I know a number of athletes who decided not to bring their families with them this time. It felt like there wasn't really an environment they were going to be relaxed in. And that's a big thing for an athlete to make that kind of move. But as far as the way it feels, so far so good. I felt no danger, no concerns.
Christopher Clary, again, a sports correspondent for the New York Times, speaking to us today from the ice rink near Sochi. David Walaszczynski is president of the International Society of Olympic Historians. His books include The Complete Book of Winter Olympics. He will be commenting on the Sochi Games for Westwood One and NBC Radio as well. Good to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to hear from you.
What about the $51 billion? Christopher Clary said, maybe they should have, at that cost, come up with a finished product. How bad is it in terms of the history of the Olympics and the readiness of all the various facilities, not just the venues?
Well, I think, as Chris said, the venues themselves seem to be in good shape. I've heard so many bad stories about the hotels that I almost hate to tell my fellow members of the media my own experience. Yesterday was my birthday, and the hotel staff knocked on my door and presented me with a birthday cake. So I thought that was a really nice gesture. So I've had a pretty good experience. Yes, it's true the escalator doesn't work in the media center. Yes, it's true that my shower overflowed, but we get used to this sort of thing. I think the media is always the last priority, certainly here.
There was a table in the room to put the cake on.
Yes, I mean, actually have two forks and on top of everything else. So that, that's been, that's been okay. The security, sure, I'm concerned, but I feel that we're probably in the safest part of Russia, to put it delicately.
What about the $51 billion cost and the claim that much of it was wasted, that it's a corrupt society and that has been on display? How do you compare it to what's happened in other cities?
I think this is kind of a gold medal performance in terms of corruption. When, anytime you have the Olympics cost four or five times as much as the previous Winter Olympics, obviously something is wrong. We've seen the story of these contracts. They went to Vladimir Putin's friends, so many of them. So that's disturbing. However, there have been other Olympics where they just weren't ready. I know that, for example, when in Athens in 2004, I remember racing up to the commentary position at water polo and feeling the steps crumble underneath my feet as I went upstairs. And then I'm sorry to say that the benchmark for bad preparation is actually the Atlanta Olympics of 1996, which had a failed computer results system, a failed transportation system. Being an American, it was obviously embarrassing.
So then, Sochi is par for the course, with the exception of the amount of money that's been spent.
In a certain extent, yes. I mean, we'll see once the competitions begin. It could go very well. It seems to have gone well so far for the first pre-day of competition.
Let me now turn to Edward Lozansky, who is founder and president of the American University in Moscow. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you for having me.
We have heard from both Christopher Clary and David Walaszczynski that maybe things aren't as bad as they have been made out to be, except for the fact that $51 billion is a lot of money. What's your take on the way that these Olympics have been reported, not just by the media, but by such commentators as David Walaszczynski?
Well, frankly, I have to admit that the first time I see some balanced reporting, because stories that you read, it just was like a horror movie. And never before, I don't recall a single issue when media was so negative, and it was really digging for horror stories. This reminds me, my background is Soviet Union, and I remember in the Soviet times, media was really trying to find some horror stories in the United States. Sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But this reminded me like a Soviet media style. 99% was bad, only horror stories. Occasionally you can find something positive, but it just maybe I would say 1%. Why such a hatred? Why it was like almost anyone who wrote the story wanted this Olympics to collapse? This is amazing. But just a couple of words about $51 billion. According to officials, this was only $7 billion, and the rest was investment, because it's not just for Olympic Games. They built hotels, they built train stations, railroads, and modernized airport. It's a long-term investment. I think they have it in mind for North Caucasus, maybe relieving some situation with unemployment. So this is a long-term project, and so maybe $51 billion is an exaggerated number, which is playing around.
Edward Lozansky, again, the founder and president of the American University in Moscow. Back to David Walachinsky, the historian of the Olympics. What about that? And do you, in fact, as I understand it, basically build an entire community that simply wasn't there before, starting on a swamp near the shores of the Black Sea. What about the idea that $7 billion went to the Olympics, but the rest is all investment in the future?
Well, the same thing happened in London. I would like to address one point that Mr. Lozansky made. This is my 16th Olympics, and I have to say, as a member of the media, there is a common thread that runs through, which is that in the days before the competition begins, in the weeks before the competition begins, we, and I include myself in the media, we're always looking for a good story, and the good story is usually a negative one about preparations. It is not unusual, the criticisms that are going on this time. I've seen it over and over again at every Olympics, and often these are justified stories, by the way. But once the competition begins, particularly after the opening ceremony, then the complete coverage almost entirely, unless there's an incident, will shift to the athletes in the competitions. In terms of the $51 billion, if I'm not mistaken, perhaps Mr. Lozansky can explain this to us, but I believe that a lot of the money that went into this infrastructure building was actually through loans that came through the Russian government.
Mr. Lozansky, I want to get back to you on that issue, but I also want to ask you this. Boris Nemtsov, the former Russian deputy prime minister, apparently did a study saying that there was, in fact, pervasive corruption in all aspects of the preparations for the Sochi Games. So not all of the negative criticism came from outside Russia.
Yes, well, I wouldn't really trust Boris Nemtsov as well. He, of course, is known as a Putin hater on grand scale. And in the past, some of his reports were exaggerated, falsified, and, this is not the man that his reputation in Russia is very low, maybe below 1%. So he doesn't hide that he hates Putin, and he keeps digging for dirt, and I wouldn't trust Nemtsov. The people who announced the number of $7 billion, very trustworthy. The guy who actually was running the whole project, I think it was Dmitry Kozak, he mentioned number 214 billion rubles, which means $7 billion. I would rather trust him than Boris Nemtsov.
Back to Christopher Clary, our sports correspondent for the New York Times, talking to us from where the ice skating is going on. What about these negative stories? Would you agree with David Walachinsky that that has been a feature of Olympics? Everybody's looking for a story, and when you've got stray dogs, for example, it's pretty hard to overlook that.
Well, I think what's fascinating about Olympics is the cultural perspective that people bring to it. And I think, both the panelists are talking about today, and they're right. I mean, I'm American. The American perspective on the games would certainly be very different than the Russian perspective on the games or the Chinese perspective on the games. But from our point of view, a stray dog story would be, an A1 story in the New York Times today for us because it touches a lot of chords and a lot of things in our society. The gay and lesbian issue, which has been very prominent here in terms of a lead-up in the Western European nations and also in North America, may not play the same way other parts of the world. I'm not saying that it shouldn't or it should, but it's clear there's a different way of looking at the games depending where you are in the world. And the games are better for that, I think, in a lot of ways. But there is a clash, and I think there's a lot of confusion that gets engendered by that. As for the negativity, I think David's absolutely right. I've covered this is my 13th Olympics, and at least the vast majority of them, there was a very, very negative drumbeat coming into the games. Even in games like Sydney, which was a big success and is viewed as a very much a positive game, has had a lot of negativity in the local Aussie media about cost, construction, everything else leading into the game. So I think it's inevitable.
Has that also been true for games that have been held here in the United States?
Absolutely. In Salt Lake City, we forget, but obviously that was the first games after 9/11. and the security issue there was massive, and they had a huge scandal that broke out that changed the IOC and caused, you know, Mitt Romney had to take over that bid. So I think almost every games, to some degree, has had a negative drumbeat. The Sochi games do touch a lot of buttons, and the security issue, because of where we are in the world and because of the way Putin is perceived around the world in many cultures.
Warman Ali back with To The Point, talking today about the Sochi Olympics. The athletes have, in fact, begun to take the stage, even though the opening ceremonies won't be held until tomorrow. We've heard a bit about that. We've also heard, however, and we'll get to talk more about the athletes as the program goes on. That's, after all, what the games are really about. But, of course, security has been a major issue. Raising the issue again, talking to CNN, was Dutch Ruppelsberger, who is the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. He is from Maryland.
One of my concerns would be a suicide attack, not where the Olympics are occurring, but, you know, people or Americans have to be concerned that are staying in hotels and transportation and buses and those type of things.
Again, Dutch Ruppelsberger with the House Intelligence Committee. David Walachensky, back to you, the president of the International Society of Olympics Historians. Has there been another Olympics where security of the kind we just heard described, or threats of the kind we just heard described, have been such an issue?
These are the first Olympics in which we've had legitimate threats from people who actually commit terrorist acts. Several weeks ago, 34 people were killed in bombings in Volgograd. Yes, it's a few hundred miles away, but that's pretty serious. And I would have to say that it would be hard to convince the survivors of those families that the terrorist threat is a fake one or something invented by Americans. The previous terrorist attacks that we've seen in Munich in 1972, in Atlanta in 1996, these came out of the blue. There were no threats. And so there is very much a different feeling here, a different situation. But I would say that the member of Congress, in a way, it's what I would say that, you know, this is the securest part of Russia right now. I would like to point out, though, that the groups that have been active in terrorist activities here, they're not aimed at Americans and foreigners. They're aimed at Russians. And so it's not like I feel that we're going to be targets. If anything, the worst thing that would happen is that we're collateral damage.
Edward Lozansky, back to you, founder and president of the American University in Moscow. Is that a fair assessment of the situation in Sochi?
Yeah, I would agree. But the only thing is that, again, in the media, there were complaints, and most notably in an article by Sally Jenkins in Washington Post, why she criticized, not only she, but she did it really dramatically. She criticized the International Olympic Committee for awarding Russia these games in Sochi in the first place because of the terrorist threat. It says the International Olympic Committee, by doing this, they're threatening lives of international athletes, of visitors, and they are to blame if something to happen. So I think that this is what I would call Munich syndrome, but not Munich 72, but Munich in the 30s of the last century, when we were yielding to Hitler all whatever he wanted just to pacify him. So just because of the terror threat, moving Olympic Games, it's like yielding to terrorists. So answer to the threat is not yielding to them and moving games to another place, but offering help. And as I understand, both U.S. and British security are helping Russia to protect both visitors and athletes. This is what should be done, but maybe on a larger scale. And President Obama would do a great thing by showing up, because then we always talk about Russia being our ally in the war of terror. So if Russia is ally on the war of terror, then you show some solidarity. You extend your shoulder, you stay shoulder to shoulder and fight terrorists instead of simply running away. But again, I'm pleased that both U.S. and British security helping Russia to protect athletes and visitors.
Edward Lozansky, founder and president of the American University in Moscow. Back to David Walachinsky, the president of the International Society of Olympics Historians. What about that? Are the Olympics, do you think, a vehicle in the war on terror of a kind? Or if there were to be casualties as a result of terrorist attacks, would you think that the IOC ought to be held accountable?
First of all, before I answer that question, I'd like to address the issue of President Obama showing up. To me, this is a false issue, because when George W. Bush went to Beijing for the Olympics, it was the first time in Olympic history that an American president had attended a foreign Olympics. This is not part of U.S. tradition for presidents to attend foreign Olympics. So to say that Obama should have shown up or that he's boycotting is completely wrong. If something does happen, and I certainly hope something doesn't, particularly because I'm here, to be honest, then I think they'll be most unfortunate. What I think is, I think that, you know, awarding the Olympics to Russia is perfectly fine. Putting it in Sochi was an odd call, particularly since it's the warmest part of Russia. And there were plenty of places in Russia where it would have been perfectly, you know, safe. Nobody would have even been talking about terrorism.
So, Mr. Lozansky, why Sochi? And you indicated earlier that really an entire community had to be built there. Aren't there other places that would have been more appropriate than the shores of the Black Sea?
But I think I mentioned this already. This was not just games or sport event. It's a huge investment project. One of the reasons for terror in the North Caucasus is the high unemployment. So I believe that one of the reasons doing Sochi, which is pretty close to North Caucasus, actually it's in North Caucasus, is maybe to create some employment, some working, some jobs for people to maybe work at those resorts and ski resorts instead of going to the woods to commit terror.
Again, Edward Lozansky is the founder and president of the American University in Moscow. Let's talk a bit about the athletes. We got to hear a little bit about what's happened already today from Christopher Clary, who is there in Sochi. Most of us are going to be watching, of course, on TV. And so will Sean Gregory, who is sports correspondent for Time magazine. Sean, good to have you on our program.
How are you?
I'm well. You have been to former Olympics, but you're not going to this one. And so one of the things you're going to be commenting on is the way in which the Olympics are covered by NBC.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how NBC does this. You know, this was they're streaming everything live, so you can watch pretty much anything you want on your computer, on your phone, on your iPad. So with the technology, if you want to watch curling at 8 in the morning Eastern time, 5 Pacific, you can do that. The issue is going to be, as it always is in prime time, everything's packaged. And since the Olympics are everywhere all the time, odds are you will know the results before you see it on prime time. So if you cannot carve schedule out of your workday to watch curling and other events, when stuff gets to NBC on prime time, you will know what happened. And that always kind of detracts from the viewing experience, but NBC has the formula down. People come, people watch anyway, and NBC execs have argued that people are more likely to watch TV when they've been watching during the day because it kind of the during the day you get Olympic fever and you can't get enough, and that's why you're going to watch at night. So it'll be a familiar storyline playing out, except this time around the Winter Olympics, you'll be able to see everything.
On the other hand, during prime time, when most people will be watching, you'll get those backstory packages about athletes and what they were doing when they were in elementary school and all of that kind of stuff. It always just seems to me somewhat frustrating when they feature those things because you have the feeling that there are events, whether it's curling or something else that most people have never heard of that are going on that it might be fun to watch, but you don't get to see them.
You don't get to see them, and but NBC knows that those packages that they might frustrate you, they may frustrate me, they frustrate a lot of people, but a lot of people do love them, and that's why they draw more casual sports fans, non-sports fans, because they're it's a familial thing, and it gets them hooked on these things. So the features, I understand, you get the violin music going, and you kind of roll your eyes a little bit. But the ratings don't lie. People, from millions and millions of people watch this, and over the last 2 years, NBC has had bigger audience every time, and wouldn't be surprised if they break the Winter Olympics record this year either, despite the time differences and it being in Europe and all that other stuff.
Will that be partly because of all the controversies we've been talking about on this program about security and about Vladimir Putin and about whether it should have been on the shores of the Black Sea and, of course, about gay rights and the gay and lesbian issue with a big delegation of gay and lesbian people and also bisexual and transgender people going to Sochi to make a point. Will that, do you think, be part of the coverage on NBC?
Well, I don't know if it'll be part of the coverage on NBC. It might be a slice of it. They're not going to emphasize it. It won't be an overwhelming part of the coverage. It won't dominate discussion like it's dominated our discussion, for good reason. But I do think the controversy and the attention on Russia, the Edward Snowden thing, all this stuff with U.S.-Russia relations being what they are, I think it's drawn more interest in the Olympics because you want to kind of figure out what's going to go on in Sochi. You know, this Sochi has now become this kind of news hotspot, and I think it's drawn more curiosity to the games themselves than they otherwise would have because, you don't follow snowboarding all the time, and you might not care that much, but you might care a little bit because it's in Russia, and we're all been talking about these issues, so you might not see coverage of these issues, but you might tune in because of them.
So, Edward Lozansky, again, president of the American University in Moscow, that's the way it looks from an American perspective. Does that surprise you?
No, your program is pretty balanced, and I really enjoy being part of it. I, of course, want to make sure that everything goes well, but it still cannot be separated from politics. And yes, maybe it's true that American presidents rarely show up, but Chinese president did show up. And by bashing Russia every day, every minute, every second, we're pushing Russia closer to China. And I don't think this is a good geopolitics. I want Russia to be in the American tent, not in the Chinese tent, but we keep pushing Russia toward China. And Chinese president showing up and Obama staying at home, I don't think it's a good geopolitics.
Okay, back to Sean Gregory, again, sports correspondent for Time magazine. We've already had one well-known athlete pull out of one, American athlete, to pull out of one event. Tell us a little bit about how significant that might be, and who are the others who do you think will be getting most of the attention from NBC in particular, but also, of course, from the consequently from the viewers, particularly in sports that haven't been Olympic events before?
Yeah, Sean White pulling out of slope style is a big deal, and it particularly is a problem and a bummer for the athletes who are left behind. You know, Sean White could have pulled out of this event 2 or 3 weeks ago, and some of his teammates have kind of led on and criticized him a little bit that he might have realized at the very last minute that he wasn't going to win. He could, that's why he pulled out. It's not because of the course, not because he was afraid of injury. So why didn't he do this a month ago and let somebody else take his place? But in the grand scheme of things, he is competing in the half pipe, which is early next week, which is where he wins gold regularly. He's won the last two golds, going for three golds. So it's not like you're not going to see Sean White. Another athlete to watch is Shawnee Davis. Now, he's been around the last two Olympics, won gold in the 1,000 meters speed skating events. He's trying to become the first speed skater to win the same event three times in a row. He's somebody to look out for. You know, in alpine skiing, Michaela Schifrin is a teenager, and in fact, her and ski jumping star Sarah Hendrickson were both not born when Todd Lodwick, who's the American flag bearer, first started competing in the 1994 Olympics. So there's that kind of extreme, too. And women's ski jumping is an interesting event. You know, it's kind of the last glass ceiling of Olympic sports. For years, women have tried to get a ski jumping event for all kinds of ridiculous, somewhat sexist reasons. They were denied. And in 2011, finally the IOC saw the light. And so it's kind of the last discipline where women are allowed to compete, rightfully so. And Sarah Hendrickson from Utah, 19 years old, very, very, the defending world champion, she's going to be one of the favorites, although she's coming off an ACL injury. So she's somebody to watch, and she's somebody that NBC will be playing up as well.
And you've written about women's ice hockey, a pretty rough game.
Yeah, no, I was lucky enough when I did this story about the Lamoureux twins, hockey-playing ladies from North Dakota who grew up playing on a pond with their older brothers, getting checked into snow and just getting beat up, and the brothers didn't care because they wanted to play hockey and make them tough, and these ladies were tough. And anyways, we were reporting this story, I was out in Grand Forks, North Dakota to meet the family, and they get into a fight with the Canadians in their hometown. And it wasn't that they started it, but they were, some teammates got hit. They stood up for their teammates, and they don't back down. They say, we are aggressive players. You know, you talk to people in Grand Forks, North Dakota, about the Lamoureux. You hear about how they used to check boys, and they were the toughest folks on the ice playing with boys. So it's no surprise that they've carried out that aggressive brand of hockey into the Olympic level.
In women's hockey, though, there's not supposed to be any checking.
There's not supposed to be checking, and that's an interesting debate within the game. Some women say, why shouldn't there be checking? It will feel more like quote-unquote real hockey and maybe attract a bigger audience. But other women say, and people within the game say, that if there's checking, it'll deter girls from playing coming in. And then, when girls play with boys, there's the physical differences that can work against them. So that debate's ongoing. But right now, no, checking is illegal. But when Canada and U.S. play, it's hard to kind of sometimes see. They play physical, and the refs let some stuff go, and call some stuff. So it'll be interesting to watch to see how physical those games get.
What about other rivalries that have been traditional at the Winter Olympics? What are you looking for there?
I think the men's hockey game between the U.S. and Russia, particularly in the environment that we're in, they play in the early rounds next week. And if they ever advance to a medal or an elimination game, that'll be a huge, the Russian hockey is kind of like, some of the Chinese athletes in Beijing, particularly the hurdler, who was under so much pressure. And then when the hurdler, got hurt at the start and he let down the country and it was tough. The country put so much pressure on them. And the equivalent to that is men's hockey for the Russians. They have to bring back gold in order. I've seen some things said that where, Russia can win 20 medals in other sports. If they don't win the gold on their home soil, that'll make all that other stuff for naught.
And what about other individual sports, that speed skating, for example? And how is the U.S. expected to do overall? NBC always keeps track of which country has won how many medals.
Yeah, the U.S., I think, they set a record in Vancouver for medals, total medals. It never seems to play. The numbers seem to go down when they're not on North American soil. In hockey, for example, the men haven't won a medal in hockey since 1956 while in Europe or Asia, outside of North America. So, I wouldn't be shocked if the medal count isn't as high, although some of the new events that have been added, such as slopestyle snowboarding, half-pipe skiing, some of these extreme events do tend to play well in America, and with the X Games on ESPN, okay, has built that whole industry. So that should maybe help make up for some of the medals that kind of go away once you start traveling a little bit.
Sean Gregory, a sports correspondent for Time Magazine. David Walachinsky, once again, International Society of Olympics Historians president. What are you looking for in terms of athletic achievement, and what do you think will be different about this Winter Olympics from those of the past?
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that I think the United States is a very well-rounded team this year, surprisingly well-rounded. However, if I'm, looking at, the events where the United States is favored to win some sort of medal, I noted that two-thirds of those potential medals are in events that didn't exist in 1988. The new events that have been added in snowboarding and freestyle skiing, women's bobsled, women's hockey, so forth and so on, these have been greatly to the benefit of North America, the United States, and Canada. So we've taken great advantage of the expansion of the Olympic program. I'd like to just make a slight clarification about Shawnee Davis, who I'll definitely be watching for. If Shawnee Davis wins the 1,000 meters speed skating again, he will be the first male athlete to win the first male speed skater to win the same event three times, because Bonnie Blair already did it, as did Claudia Pechstein. So nonetheless, that would be a tremendous achievement. I'd also be watching for Ted Ligety on the in alpine skiing, who somehow for seems to be overlooked in a lot of that, a lot of this. Also, I couldn't help but notice that today in the first training run of the downhill, you know, guess who got the first the fastest run? It was none other than Bodie Miller. So the United States is looking surprisingly good in alpine skiing. It's a very pleasing development.
Okay, great names from the present and the past, and no doubt there will be new names in the future. And a lot of talk about politics as well. Thank you all very much for being on our program. David Walachinsky, once again, the president of the International Society of Olympics Historians, speaking to us from Sochi. Edward Lozansky, the founder and president of the American University in Moscow. Sean Gregory, sports correspondent for Time Magazine, who's going to be watching on TV like the rest of us. And Christopher Clary, our earlier guest, sports correspondent for the New York Times, who spoke to us from Sochi as well. Great to have you all, and we'll hope to have you back as the games proceed.